podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's now time for our interview specials. Take a trip back in time to the golden era of football. Sit back and listen up. It's time for the main event with the Phoenix Five and a 90s football icon.
You can't win anything with kids.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Hi guys, and welcome to this week's episode of the Phoenix Five Show interview special. This week we're joined by the Premier League's first ever goal scorer, Mr. Brian Deane.
Now stands the clock at 5-3 in the Sheffield United lineup. Is the face still here? Brian Deane, who has just signed a new 2-year contract. And Deane scores! 4 minutes and 36 seconds when the ball went into the net. A long throw, no marking on Deane. And Sheffield United had the start they were looking for.
Thanks for joining us this evening. I know my Zoom thing says Becky, but my name's actually Dave. I use my missus' Zoom call. But I'd like to jump in about, I'm quite interested in your first football memories, i.e. your first World Cup you watched, players you idolised, and what actually got you into football? What started you off playing football, mate?
First World Cup was really the first World Cup where I knew what was going on was the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. You know, and they had, they had a fabulous side. They used to wear all the kit was amazing. And they had all the old sort of like, you know, big curly hair, Alberto Tarantino.
The perms, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Lucas, Kempes, Pazzarella, Filol was the goalkeeper. Bertoni, all of these guys. So that was the first, and it was a ticker tape, you know, whenever they came out and all of that. So that was my first real kind of memory of a World Cup. And was it Hugh John? The commentators then were brilliant, I'll never forget. You know, whenever I can see the actual footage in my mind, you know, I straight away think of the. Was it Hugh John? He was good as well.
But, it rings a bell, yeah. Back in 78, I think you might be right, Brian.
Yeah, it was a marvelous World Cup. You know, they had the Cubillas who played for Peru. You know, he scored the goal against Scotland. I think they beat Scotland. You know, it was just it was wonderful. And then they had the Brazil side. That was my first memory. I suppose, you know, the one where I kind of got really emotional was the 82 World Cup, because that Brazil side was probably my favourite team of all time.
That was in Spain, wasn't it? Sorry,
it was in Spain. Yeah. They had, I can't remember who the goalie was, but they had Taffarel Junior, you know, you had Leandro, Socrates, Zico, Eder,
now you're Cicinio, talking. Yeah.
What a team, man. That was when I kind of fell in love with, I had this dream of being a professional footballer, and I think it started, like I say, in the 1978 World Cup. I got after the World Cup, I got some Puma World Cup season Menotti's, who was the manager at the time. Yeah, and it was just magical. You know, I was very fortunate. I had an older brother who left to go in the Navy, but he always used to look out for me and so on. So, yeah, wonderful times.
Hey, you started your career at Doncaster and you scored 82 goals, but the club were relegated and you quickly moved on to Sheffield United for a fee of £25,000. But how did that move come around and how did you find yourself? Was it quite an easy yes decision?
Billy Bremner left to go to Leeds and Dave Cusack was the manager. And he gave me my first contract and brought me into the first team. That was my first professional contract, I actually wrote down to Doncaster for a trial, and I was fortunate that the chief scout had been at Leeds when I was a kid and accepted my letter, and took me down there, and I went down there, and I just really fitted in. It was, I just must have got there just at the right time. So it just went from there, really. So I made my debut when I was 17, and I think, you know, I kind of was part of the first team set up for the next season, because I played in the intermediates, Northern Intermediate League, they used to call it. People like Gazza and quite a few other people came through, the Intermediate League. It was a really tough league, actually, under-18 league, but it had teams like Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, Sheffield United, Sheffield Wednesday, Leeds, really big clubs in sort of like the North, encapsulated sort of like what used to be North Yorkshire plus the Middlesbrough, Sunderland, but also all those teams in and around Yorkshire. It was a really tough league, and a lot of players came through that. I got into the first team, and difficult time because I was only 18, 19. But then, I managed to find my feet. In my final season there, we got relegated, but I managed to score 10 goals. At the end of the season, they offered me a contract, which I turned down because I don't think it would have been a good marriage staying under the management of Dave Mackay anymore. We just, it was just one of those where I kind of felt undervalued, and Dave Cusack helped me to make the connection with Sheffield United, and it kind of went from there. In those days, you kind of, it wasn't so much about how you have the system now where nobody escapes through the net. I'd broken my leg at 16, and when I recovered from that, the first thing I did was write down for a trial. A couple of my friends had got apprenticeship contracts at Leeds United. I didn't get one, and I thought I'd give it one more try. And yeah, that's where the whole Doncaster thing came in. And, I'm really grateful. I had a brilliant time there. Learned a lot about myself. Stayed in digs for the first time. It was wonderful. Wonderful time.
About the digs, I mean, we've spoken to a few other players and they've all come through a different paths. Some have come through right into clubs and getting trials. Some have gone through the YTS system. Now, obviously, it's academy.
Yeah.
Would you like to see it have stayed in the way it was before in terms of your digs, cleaning the boots? The evolution now is the young kids in the game of there's no, what's the word, paying your dues, so to speak.
Look, I mean, I think I think the kids now, it's very difficult to pick on what their character is. Now I'm not saying that if I'd done an apprenticeship, I might not have made it. I might have found some of that side of it very tough. The way it worked for me worked perfectly well. I don't know, somebody up there likes me, I think, but I kind of came in at 17 and I signed a professional contract, and it kind of, if I'd have been an apprentice and had to stay till 5, I don't know how I'd have coped with that. But definitely, I think that it doesn't do any harm. I can't remember which club I was at, but they said, I remember being a professional and then hearing somebody say, oh, no, the kids don't do any boots. They don't do any of that now. And I thought, why not? What harm's it doing? We've totally changed. And I think we're reaping a little bit of what we sow. You look at the way how the game's going now, everybody wants it now. Everybody wants to be wants a Lamborghini at 21. Everybody knows who, everybody's got an answer.
Trying to run before they can walk, Dean. Is that what you're saying?
Brian, yeah.
Brian Dean, sorry, man.
Sorry. Yeah. Schoolboy era there.
Yeah, definitely.
Your first season, the Premier League comes in, obviously, in 92, which is quite pivotal for your, not for your career necessarily, but the changes in the game from 92 or from prior to that. What did you make of it? Did you have much of an excitement about it? Because you knew money was coming or the exposure was going to be greater?
I think we were just getting on with it. I mean, we're at a crossroads again now, but it was so different then. You know, the way how it changed was like, you know, we were in the game for the love of it. I know that I don't want to make that sound as though people don't love the game now, but it was different. You know, we didn't have any aspirations of becoming very wealthy when we came into football. It was just a case of doing something you loved for as long as you wanted to. Now you actually get the rewards very quickly. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, really. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it's, you know, things have changed. Back then, you know, looking at the kind of razzmatazz and everything, it was brilliant. You know, we knew that instead of getting like 10 minutes or so on a highlights program like Match of the Day, we were going to be seen, you know, they were going to actually produce live games. There was also going to be a lot of footage built around the games and around the characters and so on. So, yeah, you then become a lot more marketable. So it was great for everybody. We became, I wouldn't say household names overnight, but all of a sudden, it's not like now, you know, because, you know, it's funny, you know, like anybody can do a clips reel now and look like a trillion dollar player, you know, whereas I remember I had to put my clips together one time and I was converting it from VHS to DVD and I had to go to a studio to do it. I mean, people do that on YouTube now, you know, and put it all together. And, it's things have changed. And that kind of branding has really kind of rocketed people's stature. Sometimes, I say now that the packaging is better than the product.
And first in the Premier League, obviously, you helped the club finish 14th. And you also won the first player to score a hat-trick in the Premiership, scoring 3 goals against Ipswich. What was that like? Because obviously you'd have been, the Match of the Day would have been massive then. You'd have had a hat-trick, loads of airtime. What was your memories of that game?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we kind of, again, you know, the back then, you know, you were competing against, not only were you wanting to win games, but you were competing against players like Ian Wright, Alan Shearer, you know, David Hurst, you know, Les Ferdinand, all of these guys who were top players, and you wanted to be the top dog. And so you're kind of, if you're scoring goals, you're looking to see who scored. A lot different to now, I think. You know, there was a real respect, but there was also a kind of, you know, you wanted to be the top dog. You know, it meant a lot more to be picked for your country because there was such a depth of talent, you know, for the selection, you know, the national team coach to choose from then. So when you got in there, you knew that you were top of the tree.
Yeah. I'm glad you've mentioned about the national side, Brian. I wanted to ask you, around about that time, I think 91, 92, I had a look in and you made 3 appearances for England, didn't you, under Graham Taylor? I wanted to know, because you didn't make the squad for Euro 92, what was your relationship with Taylor? Did he give you any inkling that you might take you? Because I had a look at the squad, there was only 4 strikers that they Graham Taylor took back then. So obviously he picked you for 3 games, I think. So, yeah, what was the whole impression you got under Graham Taylor at England?
No, he was fine. Listen, he was fine, you know. I mean, he's a very honest man, very honourable. And, you know, if he didn't pick me, then, you know, he obviously felt that there were better players to pick than me at the time for whatever reason. He had enough time to look at me. I think that part of my issue back then was I wasn't very confident. You know, I came from Sheffield United and everybody's come from Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool and places like that. So I had a bit of an inferiority complex, which is quite foolish of me, but you can only know that with time and looking back. But yeah, no, look, he picked what he felt was the best players and I accept that.
Well, you mentioned that you moved on to Leeds. Howard Wilkinson came in for you at Leeds to sign you. I understand that Trevor Francis also tried to bring you to Sheffield Wednesday and actually offered more money either to you or to the club. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, no, it's true. I did meet Trevor, but I didn't feel it was viable, and I wouldn't disrespect Sheffield United by going to their closest rivals either. It just wasn't on. Whether or not I've got no axe to grind with Sheffield Wednesday, but I just wouldn't do it. You know, that's just me. You know, I've seen other people do it, but it just wouldn't have been a viable option for me. And I had too much respect for Sheffield United to go and play for their local rivals. It would just wouldn't have worked for me.
Loyalty there, Brian. Don't see that very often these days, mate.
So you well, said...
changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. You say not to play for Sheffield United, Sheffield Wednesday, sorry, and because you had played for Sheffield United. I mean, it wouldn't bother a lot of people in this day and age, I don't think. You know, obviously when you've got money, the amount of money that's flashed about, it doesn't really matter. But for you to say you respect Sheffield United that much, that's I like that. I like to hear that. That's really nice.
Well, things have changed. You know, if you look across society, things are a lot different now. And, whereas things were a priority then, you know, everything, a lot of things have changed to 180 degrees. So, you know, in honesty, you know, that was how I was brought up. You know, I'd like to think that I was a, product of my parents and the integrity and the morals that they had. But look, different ages, different times call for different outcomes as well.
Yeah. You mentioned that Leeds, you struggled to settle in when you first got there. I mean, because you came in for record fee at the time.
Yeah.
How was that to deal with? Did you not overtry? I'm trying to think of the word best play. You coming in for record fee.
It wasn't anything to do with the fee. I mean, obviously, as a goal scorer, if you're not scoring regularly, it's going to affect your confidence. But we played a different style of football. You know, when I was at Sheffield United, we played very much, I was playing on the shoulder of defenders. Whereas when I was at Leeds, I was playing with my back to goal. And it's a totally different type of game. You know, if I'm in a foot race with somebody in when I was at Sheffield United, I was going towards a goal and I'm taking people on, you know, whereas when I went to Leeds, I was being used as a setup player, a little bit like I replaced Lee Chapman. And I think that, you know, that wasn't my game. You know, at that point, I wasn't somebody who would just want to spin out to the back post when the ball was wide or, you know, I thought I had a lot more. Well, I did have a lot more to my game than that, and it involved getting the ball to my feet, taking players on. Look, I wouldn't have got anywhere near the England team, and I wouldn't have scored all them goals if that's all I did. Because when we were at Sheffield United, we didn't have the players who could drive us forward from the midfield area. We weren't really a very creative team, and that was simply down to what we could afford to do, and we were playing to everybody's strengths.
Thank you.
Okay. Leeds finished fifth 2 years in a row. Tony Yeboah comes in and you had Rod Wallace as well. How did you feel about Tony Yeboah coming in? Because he came from Germany, I think, with a decent reputation and we all know about his goals and that. So, yeah, how did you feel about Yeboah coming in?
Perfect. You know, I think when you kind of, you know, it's like when I went to Middlesbrough, you know, they brought in Alan Boxic and I'm not somebody to kind of sulk about things like that. I was glad to see Tony at the club and we worked well together. You know, it's funny because there was a program, 1 to 11 fantasy football show.
Yeah.
And, you know, they asked me what my first 11 was and I picked Tony. And when Tony did his, he picked me as well. And that's,
okay.
You know, so there was that mutual respect. We enjoyed playing for each other and he said some nice words. And obviously, what people don't realise is that when you're playing up front with somebody like Tony and he's scoring goals, it's taking the pressure off you and it's allowing you to find your game. And but not just that, just him as a person as well. Brilliant to be around and play with.
Yeah, great.
We interviewed Kevin Pressman as a goalkeeper. And we always said like how isolated as a goalkeepers union, how they work together. It's very much you're isolated and you're on your own. I kind of compared it then a bit to strikers, because a defence and a midfield have a team around them. And I know a strike, you have a strike partnership, but you are, as you said earlier on, you don't score the goals back in the day. You get chucked to reserves or you push to one side. What was that like with every game, that pressure being on, having to mentally have to be on it and score goals or replaced?
It's tough. You know, especially like I mentioned, the contract situation, because, you know, at that point, you're always playing for your next contract. It's not like now where you signed a 2-3 year deal and that's, you know, you're talking about, you know, somebody might be 30, 40, 50 grand a week. It was a lot different then. But it kept you hungry. It was difficult. It was a lot of stress. And I think man management in them days was a lot different as well. You know, the coaches, it wasn't a case of having that understanding from the coaches. It was, if you weren't on your game, they would, they'd be looking beyond you. So, you know, you had to kind of become more resilient yourself.
How was Howard Wilkinson as a manager then? Did you get on with him? If you dropped for a game, did you go and pull him to one side, or did you kind of just try hard the next game?
Look, it's difficult. You know, I mean, I found myself in situations. There was one situation which, you know, really kind of summed up what happened. And it was when we played, it was a week before the cup final, we played against Villa. And we played Everton on the Saturday, and I remember Howard coming to me and saying, you know, like, he hadn't picked the team, but, you know, he just looking for a good game from me, and he was going to, you know, that would cement my place. And I got man of the match. It was a game on television against Everton. We drew 2-2. We played a weakened team. We drew 2-2. I got both the goals, and came in the changing rooms, and he wouldn't look at me. And I knew then that I wasn't going to be playing. So, you know, that was, you know, it's one of those things where you just think there wasn't a lot I could do. And like I said, things were different then. So it's not like now where you had the, you know, you get the outcry and the social media and everything. You know, it was all, you know, you in those days, the journalists would write, you know, they'd stick to the kind of narrative that the manager wanted. So it's not like anybody was going to oppose what, you know, for example, that situation. You know, I knew it. I knew from the time I came in on that Sunday into the changing rooms with a bottle of champagne, because we used to get the Barclays bottle of champagne, the Magnum. And I came in and, you know, went around and I remember him looking at me and kind of looking through me, and I thought, here we go, you know. So, and we lost, you know, I was on the bench. And to be honest, I don't have, for me, that game just, you know, I'm just like, you know, what you reap, what you sow, really. So I didn't have any real sympathy with the criticism he got, because I felt I should have been playing. And, you know, you live and die by your decisions in the game. And that, nobody understood that decision. And it was one of those where it didn't affect my confidence, because I knew I could look anybody in the face, because I'd scored 2 goals in the previous week against Everton. So, you know, for me, I was fine with it. I could live with myself.
Okay. At that stage as well, you started getting, the non-British players, foreign players coming over, being signed into the club, like your Tony Yeboah and other players. How do you find, other players we've spoken to have said that the dressing rooms, there was a definite change from the drinking culture into the more separate groups, because you would have team bonding sessions and half of them would just wouldn't turn up for it because it's not what they want to do, like paintballing or something like that. How did you find the dressing room change? Was it for the better or for the worse, or how did you impacted by it?
We were fine. I mean, we were very professional. I mean, all the way through. I mean, at Sheffield United, we had those bonding sessions, but we also worked very hard, because we had to, in order to be able to compete with the other teams. When I went to Leeds, it was definitely more professional, but we had a team of athletes And, you know, if we had a night out, it was always well planned. But we were all, you know, we were very professional as individuals as well. I mean, we all used to, you know, I used to go down to Don Valley on my own, and I had a personal trainer I used to see on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we'd work together. And then by the end of that season, we'd work together Tuesdays and Thursdays, 4 till 6. And then by the end of that season, you know, about 10 of the players were coming down, because nobody used to do strength and conditioning and nutrition work back then. So we took it upon ourselves as a group to go down, and, you know, we reap the benefits.
Continue on the foreign players, Brian. At that time you was at Leeds, Leeds brought in Thomas Brolin. I remember from old, before we had YouTube and all the social media, et cetera, a lot of Pick football fans like myself, they knew of Thomas Brolin, seen him play for Sweden Euro 92. He was even better for Parma. But yeah. I'd just like to ask you what happened to him, because he came to Leeds with this massive reputation, probably one of the best foreigners at that time to come to play in the Premier League. And it just didn't happen. He just looked overweight. And I mean, what was it? What happened to him, you know?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't think his relationship with Howard was great. But we all had our issues, you know what I mean? And, you know, Thomas just didn't fit in. I think maybe the pace of the game over here at that time perhaps wasn't suited to his game. Although, you know, in Italy it was, you know, they were similar in terms of how they were.
Mm.
You know, so I don't know, it was a strange one. Lovely guy, and very, very talented. You know, you've seen him at the top level, that, you know, and then he came to our place and it just didn't happen. Maybe he just wasn't happy.
Yeah.
You know, so.
96-97, George Graham comes in. Did you and him have a good relationship?
I think so. I mean, George was George was an interesting character. His psychology was big part of him. He's a very good tactical coach in terms of defensively and so on. But yeah, no, he was a very hands-off type person. He didn't want anybody close to him. He didn't have favourites, which suited me. You know, I think we'd had a few of the boys had had a different relationship with the manager before. And when he came in, we kind of realised that we had to toe the line, as it were, you know, otherwise you would be out with him. He was good. He was good to play for, you know. Although, you know, because we played such a defensive sat, you know, he came in, he took over from Howard, and he steadied the ship. And then he built. Well, I got to the end of that season, and then I was leaving anyways. So you know, it was a good sort of like time. But I was also glad to leave. You know.
What? Why was your choice to leave at that stage as well, I believe? Is that, yeah. Is that correct? Why was that? Was it just that you had enough at the time, or was it the manager, or was it kind of you what you felt?
It was, well, they made me a contract offer, but I don't think it was... I couldn't sign that, you know, just out of respect for myself, and I was disappointed with the way how they'd gone about it. It was quite disrespectful, and I think that because they thought that I was a Leeds lad, that I'd just kind of sign and wanted to stay, but... You know, it's, you know, like I say, very kind of, if that's what they thought I was worth, fine, but I wasn't going to be staying. You know, I knew I could have gone elsewhere, so that's what I did.
Did you have agents at the time, or was you?
Is it I had
you?
An agent, but, you know, if I did have an agent based in Nottingham. But if I look back, you know, I'm very like that with agents. You know, I think there are some good agents, but if I look back, he was one that, you know, you look back at certain things and they weren't right. And he had a lot of clients. And I see things happening now with players and agents, and it's no different. You know, he was always kind of trying, you know, skimming and so on, you know, just not very honest.
Dodgy well, agent, Brian, eh? To say it was easy well, with a dodgy agent.
I
mean,
well, I think, to be honest, I think a lot of them were back then. It was a little bit like the Wild West. Mm. And, you know, he was like that. You know, it's only when you look back afterwards and you can see certain things, you know, it's very much, you know, players are very vulnerable. And that's what people don't realise. You know, they put a lot of trust in their agents. Sometimes it's a good thing. A lot of the times it's not. But what they don't realise is a lot of the time the agents are kind of are working for themselves. They've been given this opportunity to make money for their clients, but they're going to earn money as well. They never think of the... It's very rare that an agent will think of his client before himself and what's in it for him. And I'm just being honest. If any agent wants to take that up with me, come and see me. And as your man would say, bring your dinner. You know what I'm saying?
It's interesting because I think the agents, you're absolutely right. I mean, you had monster Eric Hall, obviously, back in the day, who was quite a focal agent. And now the problem is with agents, if you look at the higher level, is they're not just working for a player. They're working for the club, for the player, and the club's manager. There's no separating.
Lots of conflicts of interest all over the place.
That's what I'm looking
for. Yeah, I mean, my guy was, you know, he was very cute, you know, and but let's just say he was very cute all round.
Graham, I'll hand next one to you, buddy.
Yeah, okay. So 1998, you signed for Benfica, so you left one Scotsman in George Graham to go to sign for Graeme Souness, another Scotsman. I'm intrigued by this because I used to love the British player going and playing abroad. And you went to Portugal, and it was not something we really saw in the UK, especially not on television. What was it like? I mean, how did that move come about? And what was it like playing in Portugal? I mean, you play for Benfica, the one of the top three sides still today, you know. I find it amazing. What's your story with Benfica?
Well, it's just simply that the opportunity came up, and I took it. I always wanted to play abroad. I had another opportunity before then to go to Holland. And again, that wasn't right for me. But when I went to Benfica, it was definitely a kind of a test of, you know, I was testing myself. But it was great. I think when I got out there, I think really I looked at the situation and I thought, geez, is this too big an opportunity? Is this too big for me? And then it was a case of sink or swim, settle in, score some good goals.
You did,
I really didn't want to come back, but there was a lot of things going on at the club as well. So it was time for me to come back.
I must admit, I did have a look today. You scored, I mean, for the listeners as well, and everybody's listening, you've got to go onto YouTube. Brian Deeney scores fantastic. I've watched it about five or six times already. He's playing for Benfica, obviously, against Porto. You had plays as well, decent plays at the time, Cal Baborski and Nica Panduru, who was part of the Romania's golden generation. You flipped the ball on the outside of your boot, done a half turn, and volleyed it into the top bins against Porto of all teams. Yeah. Listeners, you've got to watch that goal. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah. So as you do against Porto, I mean, and you did look chuffed, you know, it was fantastic. Yeah. You did score some good goals, you know.
It was good times, and you know, we had some good players, like you say. Nuno Gomes was my strike partner up front.
Yes.
You know, we had Michel Prudhomme in goals, some other Paulo Madeira, Portuguese international. You know, we had plenty of Portuguese internationals. We had Erwin Sanchez, who was Bolivian, Bolivian international, went on to manage the national team there. We had
Scott Minto was there, sorry. Scott Minto was there before you came,
Scott,
wasn't he?
Yeah, Scott Minto, Scotty was there. João Pinto,
yeah.
There was Ovchinnikov, who was a Russian national goalkeeper as well.
Okay.
Some very good players there.
What was the dressing room like? An English dressing room against a Portuguese dressing room? Was there a massive difference in culture?
The guys made us feel welcome. I mean, I think it's slightly different in that you have to earn the respect over there. I think we have a lot of players who come over and we just welcome them here. But, you know, it was a little bit different over there. You know, they're all quite sceptical about you until they see what you can do.
What about the smoking culture? Was there much of a smoking culture in the dressing room?
There was a few people who smoked in the car park.
No one at half time, no?
No, which was quite funny. After training, some of them would nip away for a cheeky fag. But I also know I've had some teammates who have, been like that when I was at Leicester, for example. So that was quite funny.
What was Souness like to work under? You worked under some great managers. I mean, Souness, I don't know, Wilkinson, maybe not, but Souness and George Graham. Did Souness out there, was he speaking Portuguese or was it still very much of an interpreter?
No, I mean, they all speak English, you know. A lot of the, you'll see with the Portuguese players, they all speak good English, and it was an easy place to settle from that point of view. There was no issues like that. It was a brilliant place to be, you know, right on the coast. Fantastic, really was.
Managers, I've read a few interviews you've done and talked about British managers managing abroad, which was more common back then than it is now. You referred to it as kind of the awareness of going outside of their remit was more narrow, whereas now obviously there's a lot more out there. Why do you think British managers don't go abroad anymore?
Because everything's here, isn't it? Nobody wants to test themselves. We're very insular here. And look, I had to go abroad because I wasn't getting an opportunity here. You know, so that's the first thing. And, you know, I wanted to see if it was something that I could do. So that's why I went and did it. I think we've created a very comfortable situation here. And, you know, perhaps that's the reason why we don't produce more rounded coaches, because we don't go and sample another culture. Or we don't bring back experiences of dealing with players in different ways. Tactics and all the rest of it, you know, we're very much kind of the budget is here. That's why people don't travel, you know.
It's a shame.
I was going to say, do you wish you could have stayed at Benfica a lot longer? Because you seem, the way you're talking, you really enjoyed it there. Obviously, you had the climate and whatnot as well. Obviously, it was massive help. And,
you know, I did, if I'm honest, I wanted to stay out longer, but I think there were some things happening at the club and, you know, I'd grown tired of it, and an offer came in, and I thought, I want to go. You know, it was, some of the issues outweighed some of the great things that happened out there, and it's not like something I want to go on and bring up or whatever. I just know that, you know, I would have liked to have stayed abroad. I would have liked to have gone to Spain, you know, maybe France at the time. You know, if the right clubs were there, but it didn't happen. And, you know, in the end, I was happy to come back as well.
We went to Middlesbrough. We spoke to Robbie Musto, who told us how crazy that period of Middlesbrough was with Brian Robson and Ravenelli coming in, Janino, and the changes there. What did you find? How did you find the Borough dressing room when you was there?
And it was great. It was, I mean, I was there same time as Robbie. We had a good time. It was fine. It was, you know, we got some real, we had some real characters. You know, obviously Gazza was there, Gary Pallister, you know, Christian Ziga, Janino, Hamilton, Ricard, you know, lots of very, you know, we just, at times we just didn't gel as a team, but all the guys there were brilliant guys, you know. I've got nothing but fond memories about Middlesbrough.
What was Gazza like as to play with? Because Roy Musto told us he was just mad as a hatter. Did you experience that with him as well?
I think that's probably a good description. If I look back, it was, you know, he was quite haunted by the whole thing. And it was, you know, watching it all unfold was difficult at times. You know, because you could see this guy who was extremely talented player, but was quite flawed in other ways as well. You know, I don't think it's wrong for me to say that. It just was how it was. And it's a real shame because he could have been, you know, right up there with a lot of other players, but it was just, he struggled to, you know, he really struggled at times.
Is there anyone there you didn't get on with in any clubs? You sound like you kind of quite...
Well, there was one person, but I'm not going to talk about him. Sorry. There was somebody who I always felt it was a real weird one, because there were times where with this person where I just thought it could kick off anytime. I didn't know why, but in the end I thought, okay, if that's going to happen, then that I won't be stopping. You know what I mean? I couldn't understand why this person was a certain way, but I always remember there was an incident in training, and I managed to refrain myself from, but that's the thing, you see, if you go down that road and something happens, you don't know what the end result's going to be. But there wasn't really many people I didn't get on with, but I think, you know, when you don't get on with somebody, and there's the only other time I've had a similar relationship when I went into management with somebody, and there's just a vibe in the room where you just can see that it's like opposites, pull, you know.
Yeah.
And if I look back now, I would have probably dealt with it a little bit differently, not as calmly, but I didn't know what the consequence might have been.
Yeah, at that time, yeah.
Was you younger at that stage, or is it later on in your career?
Well, I was 30-odd. I was just coming up to 30, I think, 30, 31.
Do you think you would have dealt with it differently if you was younger? If this same person you had a clash with, do you think you would handle it differently?
It's difficult to say, because I don't know. You know, if I would have probably dealt with it differently if I was older.
So, but Paul, were you asking basically like, is his temperament, Brian's temperament, would it have changed when he was younger? He like sort of thrown a punch? Do you know what I mean? As you know, when you were in your 30s and that happened, you like calmed down. Is that the sort of route you mean?
No, I think it'd have been the other way.
The other way. Oh, okay.
I think, I always got on with everybody, but there was times where I let things go. But I think that if I sat and kind of looked at the situation, I would have dealt with it differently. And the thing is, because I was so calm, a lot of the time, you know, people would misread that. But, you know... Yeah, different.
Throwing out for you, just end of the show kind of thing, we ask some random questions. First thing that comes into your head, just answer for me. So the best manager you worked under?
Oh, no. No, that's not an easy question. I'll tell you why, because there's different managers are good for different things, all right? So if you say, who got the best out of me at the time, I'd say Dave Bassett.
Dave Bassett, okay. Giggs or Overmars, who's the better player?
Oh, very tough. I'd say Giggs.
Yes. How many... Arsene Wenger or George Graham, who is the better manager? Okay. Oh, okay.
That's straight away.
Steak or fish?
Both.
90s or noughties?
90s, 90s, yay. Okay, man, come on. Yeah.
Best goal you scored?
At which club?
Any club in your career.
Gotta be that Benfica one against Porto, surely.
Yeah, that was a good one. scored a good goal for Leeds against Tottenham. Scored a good goal for Sheffield United against Liverpool. Yeah, different eras.
Best dressing room you was in?
For banter?
Yeah.
I'd say tied with Leeds and Leicester. Leeds first time around, but Leicester was hilarious.
Best strike partner?
Oh, God. Again, tough one, because in terms of production, Tony Garner.
And last question, in terms of any change to your career, if you could make any change to your career and go back and change it, would you make any? And if so, what would it be?
I think I would have been, yeah, I would have definitely have been, I'd have believed in myself more.
Fantastic. Brian, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Been a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Sports Social Podcast Network.